The Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسمعهم
This is Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad.
Global Security Matters.
Good evening. This is Adrian Morgan with my co-host Reese Cup, full of peanut butter goodness, bringing you Global Security Matters on Friday, October the 7th, 2011. It is now 6 o'clock Eastern Time. And we were discussing last week the issues of Anwar al-Awlaki and the use of drones. And really, there hasn't been a great amount of follow-up news to that. I mean, in a way, the news of Steve Jobs' demise has eclipsed a lot of the recent the news which has been going on. On Tuesday, there was a massive bomb, a truck bomb, in Mogadishu, in Somalia. Now, considering Somalia is currently under a massive famine, having a truck bomb which killed initially 65 people on Tuesday, the death toll then rose to over 100, seems to be a very bizarre way of trying to get attention. And this was carried out by Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab being the Somali wing of Al-Qaeda, tied up very closely with Al-Awlaki's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula network, which is on the other side of the water there. So it just seems very, very strange for Al-Shabaab to admit responsibility for this bomb. I don't know what they're really trying to achieve. And everything that's been going on with the Arab Spring is now getting closer and closer to a state of being an absolute pig's breakfast. Syria, there were 7 people killed today. Strikes on very close to the Turkish border, because a lot of people have been trying to flee from Syria. And Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is the Turkish Prime Minister, the one who used to be Israel's ally but is now talking very tough words about Israel, he also has lost out from this bomb in Mogadishu, because at the UN last week he made a big speech and he was saying about how he was going to step in and he was going to support Somalia, because nobody was talking about Somalia, and he was going to be the big I am, the big hero who was going to walk in there and he was going to draw the world's attention to Somalia and he would be the one to sort out its problems. He's obviously trying to maneuver himself and manipulate. Now, after a lot of people had walked out on Thursday last week in the United Nations because of the speech which was made by Ahmadinejad, then you had basically Erdogan was talking and he was being very provocative about Israel himself. You know, a lot of countries had walked out after basically Ahmadinejad of Iran had been going on about denials of the Holocaust, as he normally does. And this was the day before Mahmoud Abbas had tried to talk about getting a new charter in. This is the other week, I mean, I'm saying, not last week. And basically, Erdogan had spoken about making Somalia his big mission to try and sort it all out because of the famine, because of the political problems. And so right on his, as soon as he's drawn attention to it, then he has this massive truck bomb. Now, the whole, it's very interesting to watch the development of Islamist terror groups. They often start off in a very amateur fashion. Al-Shabaab, initially, they used to have sports bars in the 2005. Now, sports bars, there'd be a satellite television there. People would be watching soccer or other sports from around the world and drinking coffee or something a bit stronger. Now, they used to use sticks and violence, which could be applied by fists and by sticks in 2005. Occasional shootings, but mostly it was physical violence and intimidation. Then in summer, in Kenya, they had another sports bar. They actually blew a bomb up inside it. And now they've gone to using bombs in Mogadishu, in the capital, which they only recently, you know, ceded defeat and said they no longer had any control over Mogadishu, the capital. Now they've moved back in to say, well, if we haven't got control, at least we can terrorize you, we can bomb you. This is often how things go. They, as a movement, starts off with small actions. For example, in Bangladesh, you had in August of 2005, in 63 of the country's 64 districts, you had one day in which masses of very small IEDs were set off. Only two people were killed, quite a few were injured. There was an adult male and a boy in two separate incidents amongst these. About 110 bombs in 63 districts were all set off. Now, these were very small bombs, but then the interest that created in the financiers of terrorism, particularly a group called the Revival of Islamic Heritage Society, meant that more money suddenly got swamping into that region, and all of a sudden the bombs became an awful lot. That year in 2005, by the end of that year, after Ramadan, which at that time was, I think it ended end of October, you suddenly had massive campaigns of suicide bombing. It escalated from small little homemade bombs, which managed to kill two people out of like 110 actual bombings, to being suicide bombings where several people would be killed at once in court cases and places, in courtrooms and other venues. And so it is with Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab hardly didn't even exist in 2005, but the people who were going around attacking the sports bars, these were the emergent people who would eventually become tied up with the Islamic courts, who did take over the country in June 2006. They took over the country for a while. And the current leader of the transitional government in Somalia is a man who had been, a man called Sharif, who had been one of the heads and one of the judges of the Islamic courts, who had taken over, started to implement Sharia law. But it was around about 2007, 2008, that's when Al-Shabaab started to appear as an entity, and they then started to attract from American, you had Muslims going over from American places in Detroit and other areas, Michigan, you know, where you had a lot of immigrants. You had a truck bomber who killed about 30 people driving a truck. It turned out to be American. So, again, this is something which had graduated, and now Al-Shabaab, money is pouring into it, just like money had poured into Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, just like with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, has been attracting money from these financiers of terror. Now, how people finance terror, there used to be a thing called the Hawala networks. After 2001 and 9/11, they realized that there were a lot of means by which money was able to be transferred from one country in the Islamic world to another one. Now, the Hawala traditions were basically done because Islam doesn't allow usury and doesn't allow people to take interest from accounts. But if you have somebody going and doing a favor for you, you can pay them. So what happens is, with the Hawala networks, if you want to pay somebody, you basically give them an address, you say, go and pay that person here, and that person then quite secretly takes the money, and then somebody elsewhere gets that money. Nobody really, there are loads and loads of Hawala networks. There have been attempts to break these traditions. They've all failed. Afghanistan has also had many of its banking systems have been, they evolved from Hawala networks, which is why there have been, you know, corruption, many of them have collapsed. Now, I suppose the main news politically is the comment which was made by Stanley McChrystal. Now, Stanley McChrystal, about a year and a third ago, he had made an interview in Rolling Stone, and he had made disparaging comments about President Obama, and he had been invited to come all the way from Afghanistan out to Washington, and then he was ceremoniously sacked by Obama. But he's still making comments, and he made a comment saying that the war in Afghanistan is only half finished, and it will take several years for Afghanistan to come to some form of achieving its targets of peace. What's happening at the moment? You have a rise in attacks on music bars. The Taliban also have another tactic which they're using in Afghanistan, of mobile phone networks are being switched off every evening. Early evening, you can no longer make any mobile phone calls, you can't get online, you can't use the internet. And basically, this is a way of the Taliban saying, we have control. And it's a subtle tactic, and it's a psychological tactic, but it works. Now, the situation has been made worse recently as well, because with McChrystal's comments, then you also have got the Hamid Karzai, the leader of Afghanistan's government. You know, there is, again, there are speeches from him and his people who are suggesting that there are the risks of Afghanistan returning to a civil war. You know, when NATO's major combat troops depart at the end of 2014, there is a big suspicion that there could be a massive civil war happening. But then again, this is a commissioned report, you know, that by the British, David Cameron had commissioned it. But Hamid Karzai did admit that his government had done very badly in giving, you know, security to Afghans. And what's been happening recently is the Taliban have already been making their mark. You had, when the Taliban were in power, when Mullah Omar and his cronies were in power, music was banned. Anybody who was caught with a cassette or a CD or a video would end up being publicly flogged. That all disappeared, but recently, people who run in Jalalabad and other places like that, people who run music shops, have been finding that they've had threats of bombs, and there have been bombings in certain places. So there is a climate of fear. The Taliban are being wooed by the American administration. The British Army has been wooing the Taliban, talking with them for a long time now. The United Nations are trying to talk with the Taliban too. Hamid Karzai has been talking with the Taliban. The Pakistan government has been funding Taliban terrorist operations. So Afghanistan is something. General McChrystal's comments were basically pretty much common sense. And this other aspect that the David Cameron's report, which is then coming out with comments from Karzai and others saying that, you know, when the pullout will happen in 2014, the country won't be ready for it and the Pashtun belt will erupt. And, you know, a lot of Taliban currently are hiding out in Pakistan. Most of the Taliban are Pashtun. And the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's porous. It's an artificial border, ethnically, culturally, even to do with marriages and family relations. The people who are on the side where Waziristan in Pakistan is, and the people who are on the other side within Afghanistan, there is a confluence. People travel over the mountains. The border means nothing to them. Many of the Afghanistan Taliban currently seeking refuge, lying low amongst the Pakistani Taliban, waiting for their moment. I mean, this was obvious this was going to happen when they had the surge, you know, and then they, as soon as they said that they were going to leave, once you say you are going to have a certain date for leaving, then it's obvious the Taliban were going to retreat slightly, knowing they were just going to regroup themselves, get their energies up, get their supplies and their resources ready, and then as soon as there will be the proper pullout, they will sweep down into the valleys and they are going to control large areas of Afghanistan. So, it's all doom and gloom. Any of Obama's rosy predictions he's tried to make out throughout his presidency, particularly last year, he made a lot of speeches about pulling out of Afghanistan, giving times and deadlines for it. It's not going to happen the way that he wants it. And by pushing the date of the withdrawal into 2014, he conveniently sidesteps the realities which people will see. That if he makes it before that, before the election, and it doesn't go according to plan, he will lose credibility. But by pushing the date to hypothetically 2 years into his purported next presidential term, it gives him some sort of edge. But quite frankly, Afghanistan is somewhere which, personally, I don't think is worth keeping to defend. Lots of money is going to go into building a massive city called New Kabul City or Dishabs. You know, it's just north of the existing Kabul. And it's going to be funded by Europeans. There's a Japanese lady who's supervising it. It's been designed on paper to look wonderful. There are mining operations nearby, which the Chinese are wanting to run. But basically, I cannot see any of that coming to power because they are all of these plans to build this massive new city will rely on Afghanistan having a stable government. Afghanistan is run by a bunch of crooks. Hamid Karzai is crooked as they come. He's already been known to have done deals with the Taliban on the quiet. They haven't worked out in his favor. He tried to rig the last election. And even then, when he got in on a second vote, there were still questions about how he had managed the voting and rigging the ballot. So Afghanistan has not had really much of a hope of stability recently. It never has. The Russians failed. The Taliban took over in September the 27th, 1996. A few years after the Russians had left, they had about 5 years of anarchy, basically. The United Nations trying to keep things under control. And as I was saying last week, Mohammad Najibullah, who was the elected premier, the prime minister of Afghanistan, he and his brother were castrated and hanged, while Taliban members holding shoulder-mounted missile launchers were all smiling underneath them for photographs. That was the launch of the Taliban into the world. And then they invited Osama bin Laden, who had previously stayed at places like he'd been in Sudan, he'd been in Khartoum as a guest of Hassan al-Turabi, and he was then invited to go with his fighters, who had already been there during the war against the Russians, and they were given a safe passage there. Many of them had gone off to go and fight in after the leaving of the Russian army. A lot of them had gone to fight in Bosnia. Then at the end of the Dayton Accords, a lot of them then moved back to Pakistan, set up the Taliban with the help of people like Colonel Sultan Tahrir, he's actually been kidnapped. Nobody knows what happened to him, but he was a senior figure within the ISI, and he has helped to set up, one of the several people in the ISI who helped to set up the Taliban. And now the Taliban are still working with the ISI. The ISI is also working with the Haqqani network, which has been working with the Taliban for quite a long time. It is a mess in that region. Now, Pakistan at the moment is also in a mess. It's got political problems between Ali Asif Zardari and Gilani, who are of the Pakistan People's Party. They are under severe attack from the opposition. Zardari has given over a lot of his powers of presidency to Gilani because he's basically, he is so corrupt and so disliked. He was the husband of Benazir Bhutto. She was in power in the 1990s. She had been forced out of being in power because of corruption. Her husband, Ali Asif Zardari, was known as Mr. 10%, because whenever tractors or anything were being brought into Pakistan, they had to go through Karachi, the port, and for the containers to be offloaded off the ships and then to be put onto trains or onto trucks to be taken to the rest of Pakistan or further north. Zardari had been creaming off loads of money with Benazir Bhutto, knowing full well all about this. They were at the time that she was killed on December the 27th, 2007, by a bomb attack, which they now believe was also the Haqqani, you know, and Taliban were involved with. When she was killed in a bomb attack when she was going around, she'd just returned back. She'd been living in London in exile. She had returned. And when that had happened, she was already wanted in Switzerland, along with Zardari, for corruption charges. Zardari has been suspected of two murders, never actually been prosecuted for those, but they believe one of the people that he killed was actually Benazir Bhutto's brother, you know, his wife's brother. But the pair of them were, Switzerland in particular, because it had offered a lot of arms and agricultural items and things, which should have helped the economy of Pakistan. basically they have to pay blackmail money to Zardari in order to let them go through. Karachi in Sindh province, Karachi is the main port on the south east part of the coast of Pakistan, you know, adjoining India. And Karachi at the moment is being exposed as being somewhere which has got where Zardari comes from, where he has his power base. There is no hospital, there are no proper schools in this one region of Sindh, on the outskirts of Karachi. And what is happening is that polio is coming back in massive amounts. Now, polio is one of those diseases which could have been stopped. Polio, it's transmitted very often through fecal matter which has got into water supplies. But vaccinations have been available for it. And unfortunately, what has happened is that in Africa, in parts of India, in the Swat Valley, which is in the northeast of Pakistan, you have had imams saying that this vaccination to immunize people against developing polio has all been part of a plot by the Americans to make Muslims sterile. So in these regions which have poor sanitation, where polio is more likely to thrive, because of the extremism of imams in the northern regions of Nigeria, where all of the 12 Sharia states are in operation, in the Swat Valley, in the northeast of Pakistan, and in Sindh province as well, and in parts of India, Muslim imams have said, no, we won't allow you to do vaccination programs against polio. Now, polio is debilitating. You end up with people who are not only lame, their bodies are bent in two. You know, children going around literally on all fours because of the bones in their legs and in their spines are all deformed. I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt had polio. You know, he very rarely showed himself standing. Or, you know, he'd sometimes be seen sitting in a chair for publicity photographs with a child on his lap. Or he would be in his car, or he would be photographed behind a desk. But he very rarely allowed people to see the fact that, you know, he couldn't walk easily unaided. Now, polio could have been eradicated. Yeah, you know, like smallpox has been eradicated, but it's been the resistance has happened directly from Muslim imams, and not only that, where these Muslim imams have demanded that there be no vaccinations, polio combined with poor sanitation has been on the increase, and recently the chief minister of Sindh province has been shamed by what's been going on. He's saying that there is going to be no excuse, they are going to enforce measures to try and get rid of polio in Sindh province. But it won't work as long as you have these myths that it's the Americans and probably the Jews too helping them, who are deliberately using vaccinations to make Muslims sterile, because then they think there'll be less Muslims around. It's a paranoid fantasy, and when people are ill-educated, and Islam does not encourage people to be educated properly, that is unfortunately one of the things that happens. Now, I have got a lot of news items. Most of them are small items, but I have a lot of quite interesting things that have been going on. In Switzerland, a mayor has resigned because he made comments about immigration being wonderful, and most of the immigrants are of Turkish origin in the north of Switzerland, and he was saying it was so wonderful and so great that he ended up getting death threats from his constituents, so he's resigned from being an MP. The mayor of Malmo in Sweden, now this is quite interesting because Malmo is one of those regions where Fjordman, the blogger who Anders Behring Breivik, quoted extensively in his manifesto, had written articles about the crime and the amount of rapes going on in Malmo, where Muslim immigrants were running amok and attacking non-Muslim individuals, particularly women, and raping them. Now, that was very controversial because in Sweden they tried to repress facts and figures. But the current mayor of Malmo, now, he is called Ilmar Reepalu. Now, he's proposed to make the people who have become new citizens to Sweden to make their citizenship temporary, and that as soon as they commit crimes, that they should be deported. And he's of the Social Democrat Party, which is a left-wing party, and all of his colleagues are now saying that that is just pure racism. I mean, what he said was to the Sydsvenskan newspaper, he said, "I believe this should be applied more often, that more active criminals who are not Swedish citizens should be deported." Seems like common sense to me, but Sweden obviously won't go along with it. Now, I'm just reading from an article in the local here. Now, this is mostly the problems are in one district in the city of Malmo. Malmo is in the south of Sweden. It is very close to Denmark. And a lot of immigrants have come over, not Danish, but they are people who've been in Denmark from Muslim countries and have crossed over, and they've settled in Malmo. Now, in the Seded district, during the spring, there was massive police surveillance program to try to reduce the massive amount of crime. Postal workers, according to the article, postal workers in the area now carry a personal alarm. Many residents say they don't dare go out at night. And the mayor said, "We cannot have a society where children who are struggling in school see these young men leading a criminal lifestyle and controlling the whole area just because everyone is afraid of them." And he is talking common sense. If people become moving to a country, if they're not going to abide by the terms and conditions of those countries they move to, if they want to set up gang law. Now, something happened in St. Louis, which is very shocking indeed, where a Muslim man, for being heretical, let me now bring that up if I can find it. Now, in St. Louis, this is from Pajamas Media yesterday. Now, an immigrant from Iraq called Mr. Alaa Al-Saig, S-A-L-S-A-E-G-H, apparently on August the 14th, 2011, in St. Louis, Missouri, he was stabbed, and in his back they carved a Star of David, all because he said that it was terrible what had happened to the Jews in the Holocaust. And the Muslim community of St. Louis, Missouri, decided that this was so terrible that he should be made an example of, and they attacked him. According to Noni Darwish, he was driving along in Compton Street near Park Avenue, and a small white car cut him off, and another car stopped behind him. In both cars, people got out, and a gun was pointing at him. They pushed his upper body down against the steering wheel, stabbed him, pulled off his shirt to expose his back. Then, with a knife, they carved the Star of David onto his back while laughing, while they recited a poem which he had written, in which he expressed sorrow over the fate of the Jews in the Holocaust. He was called an infidel. He's already received threats in the community for supporting Jews. Now, this is the crap that is being brought with Muslims, along with honor killings and arranged marriages and other assorted anti-freedom, anti-democratic attitudes. Now, I'm getting little notices, I believe. Holger has got a question. Is he online in the studio? Oh, no, he's just got a question. His question is, what European country is the least tolerant of the Muslims? Whew. I think you have to say that it's not so much the countries as parts of the country. For example, in Italy, I'd say Italy is probably becoming quite intolerant. It used to be very tolerant, but the Lega Nord in the north, they have been very intolerant of Islam. But recently in the south, since you've had lots and lots of Muslim immigration from Libya, and Gaddafi was helping to operate a lot of that, it seems that, you know, Italy's one of the places where there's a lot of intolerance. Switzerland is rapidly becoming intolerant of Islam. I mean, in the sense of it had been pushed too far towards multiculturalism. Then you had the issues with Gaddafi. Gaddafi, his son Hannibal, had been in 2006 or 7. No, 2007, I think it was. He had been caught in a hotel room with his wife beating up a maid. And when he was arrested for this, Gaddafi then, who had been supplying 50% of Switzerland's oil, 50% of their natural gas as well, there was a blockade put onto Switzerland. Then two Swiss businessmen in Libya had been kidnapped and held hostage for a whole year. Then Gaddafi went to the United Nations and had said that, you know, Switzerland should be abolished. So now, around about the time they had the minaret ban, which had been going on a couple of years ago as well, this was all connected with this sort of rising abhorrence of what was going on. You also had in Geneva, there was a mosque there that was run by Hani Ramadan, the brother of Tariq Ramadan. Both of them are the grandsons of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. Their father is Saeed Ramadan, who married Hassan al-Banna's daughter. Tariq Ramadan, he's now allowed into America. He was banned for a long time. He's been feted in France and in Britain. He's at St. Andrew's College in Oxford University. He's doing studies there. He's even under the Labour government when they had a seminar on extremism. He was called in to give advice, even though he's not a British citizen. Tariq Ramadan has this impression, this aura that he gives, that he's tolerant. His brother Hani Ramadan is a total... He doesn't care what the media thinks. I mean, in France, whenever he arrives in France, there are demonstrations by women because he has said women should be stoned to death if they commit adultery. He believes in Islam being enforced by the Sharia, the methods of law. So I would say Switzerland at the moment is one of the countries which, and Switzerland again, it abuts onto the north of Italy, you know. So I think, you know, it's a, there's a region there where there is a resistance is growing. You know, so this Swiss mayor, he was just a mayor of a small town in northern Switzerland, and he's left office after positive comments he made. Now, he's called Josef Butler, the mayor of Spreitenbach, and he found that defending the integration of immigrants in Switzerland can turn into a nightmare, because in this town, which only has 11,000 inhabitants, which is tiny, more than half of them are of foreign origin, and for that, read Muslim. And he had gone on TV and he'd praised the coexistence and said that immigration represented a challenging enrichment. When you have a community which has only had immigration really going on in the last 20, 30 years, a lot of people remember how a country used to be and how it's become now. Sweden, parts of Sweden are very... they're very anti, you know, around Malmo in particular, you know, because of what's been going on. You've got Aarhus in Denmark, which is another area where Muslims believe they can run amok and tell other people not to go out after nights, and they sort of try to impose this tribal rulership of the areas. I mean, there are parts of Britain where they are Muslim no-go areas. There's a man of, a black man, a leftist, a man called Darcus Howe, in a few years back, he did a documentary. He went around neighborhoods and was finding that Muslim kids were telling him that he could not, because he was black, he could not come into their streets. And he was trying to do a documentary, you know, about... the way that gang cultures, gangs governed by Islam, you know, etc., and gangs governed by ethnic origins, were carving up cities and areas into like these patchworks, you know, where before there had been integration vanishing. I mean, we had a massive riot in Birmingham in the end of 2005. This was a riot where black people were being they were attacking Muslims, and then Muslims were then attacking innocent black people in return. The whole thing, the multicultural experiment, went awry. So I don't know if there's any one country where there is resistance to Islam. Because you get people like David Cameron has said that he multiculturalism doesn't work, and then he goes and just encourages more multiculturalism. You have Angela Merkel in Germany. She's also said in March this year, multiculturalism doesn't work. And yet, she is still doing deals with Turkey. Most of the immigrants in Germany are of Turkish origin. Now, these aren't just Turkish origin from the Istanbul region who have been influenced by Ataturk secularism. These are mostly from the Kurdish regions in the east of Turkey, where the message of secularism never really got through very far. If you ever read, there's a book by Orhan Pamuk called Snow. Now, he was a Turkish author. He was put on trial for being against Turkey, because he had mentioned the Armenian genocide of 1915. But in his book Snow, he was, you know, accused of being anti-Turkish, even though he's a Turkish citizen. And he gave an interview with a Swiss magazine in which he mentioned the Armenian genocide, when Armenians were forced to walk miles and miles, and men, women, and children starved to death, died of exhaustion, and Turkey still refuses to acknowledge that that had happened. But in the east of, in the eastern regions of Turkey, around Lake Van, you have got a culture where honor killing used to be, until Turkey tried to join the European Union. If you committed an honor killing of a sister or anyone else in your family who you felt wasn't living up to Islamic standards, there were a special dispensation. If you killed your sister and you said it was because she'd gone out with a man and she'd shamed the family, you'd get 2 years in jail, you'd be let out. Now, what then happened in the east of Turkey? A lot of the people who moved to Germany are from those regions, and they are the ones who are committing honor crimes. They are also involved in New Köln, which is an area just near Berlin, where there's one particular school where Muslim students refuse to let women teach them because they believe that they, you know, Christian infidel women, no, we're not going to have that. There are a lot of social problems arrive with massive immigration of people who don't want to integrate. If you don't integrate into the society, you have problems. I mean, for example, in the Netherlands. Netherlands has always had a liberal culture. And its liberal culture has been tolerant of Jews when other countries wouldn't allow Jews on their soil. So you ended up with Baruch Spinoza. His family had been come over from Spain. And in the 17th century, Baruch Spinoza became, he only lived till he was 44, but he was a brilliant philosopher, Jewish. And from that tradition, the Netherlands has always been seen as a liberal place of ideas where people can express themselves. It's had sexual freedoms. It's had the notorious coffee shops where you can buy cannabis or cannabis cakes, and they've had a gay culture. And what they've found now is they've imported loads of Moroccan youths, and all of a sudden their idea of the tolerance towards homosexuals is suddenly being threatened by having gay people are being beaten up all the time by Muslim youths. So it's, the challenges are there. In the Netherlands now, they have a 16% of the population of the Netherlands is Muslim. And the Netherlands is not a very large area. The same thing with Belgium. You know, you get certain areas where it's natural for groups to go where their relatives are who might speak the same language. But they create problems when they don't integrate, and they, and then you can't talk about this without being accused of being a racist. I mean, we had a man called Trevor Phillips who, because he was black, he was allowed to talk about it. Now, he did a lecture. He was head of a racial integration group, and he made a very important speech. I think it was the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, in which he was talking about Britain was sleepwalking into segregation because you have these Muslim ghettos in most cities. And it was particularly with Muslim groups which he was talking about. And now, because we've had a lot of people from Europe with the open borders, it's interesting, areas where Muslims were in 2001, in about July and August, cities in the north of Britain, Bradford and Oldham, had race riots where Muslim youth, mostly of Pakistani origin, some Bangladeshis, fighting against, they were attacking churches. There were a couple of people who were old war veterans were attacked. Running battles, mostly the violence was being carried out by Muslim youths. It was suppressed. It's one of those things the media did report on it, but tried to blame it all on the fact that racists from the British National Party had tried to stand candidates in a local election. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of tensions which happen with multiculturalism when people don't integrate. And it's not about race, this is about ideology and language. If you don't learn the language and if you don't want to be part of the culture, we've got areas of Britain where you do have Muslim communities, people who Muslims themselves are being bullied into conforming. Women are being bullied into wearing veils. There's an issue in Brick Lane in the East End of London. A woman of Bangladeshi origins who is Christian, working in a chemist, and she has been threatened with death. The chemist, the druggist, you know, which she works for, has been threatened with having its premises burned down by employing this woman because they say she must wear a veil. Even though she's Christian, they say that, well, because you're from Bangladesh and most people from Bangladesh are Muslim, you must be like us. And you can't be a liberal Muslim. You must be, you know, you must be conforming. And then you get groups like Anjem Chowdhury and his Islam for UK, Al-Mujahideen, he's had lots of different names for it, going around putting up posters saying that he's going to make areas of Britain become under Sharia control, and that is actually starting to happen. You know, it is, we have got horrific situations going on in Britain, which people, because of multiculturalism being put, put forward as being this ideal that we should strive to achieve, it's become, that's the dogma, it's heretical to even criticise that. It's a very difficult issue, because it's not about racism, because I'm totally opposed to racism, but I'm also totally opposed to having these bubble communities. Now, what's happening in the north, in these towns in the north of Britain, which in 2001 had exploded into racial violence, into sort of Muslim on upon non-Muslim violence, where all of those things had happened. The Muslims had initially arrived in the 1960s. They'd been invited in by people like Enoch Powell, who was then labelled as a racist for his statements about the future of Britain. Now, he had actually invited a lot of people from the Indian subcontinent and from the West Indies to come to Britain to do the jobs that British people in the early 1960s didn't want to do. Now, when they had moved into areas, there was a so-called white flight. People didn't want to live in an area where the women were all dressed with, you know, veils and things. Not face veils, but, you know, headscarves and so on. And what is now happening is that the Eastern European people from Czechoslovakia and Poland are moving in. And in some of these Muslim areas in the north, they are now buying up flats or renting apartments within these communities. And the Muslim community leaders are outraged because they feel that they are having their community has been invaded, when they had already invaded themselves. So it's one of those, it's just very bizarre. I mean, you have round about the East End of London, you know, it's an area I used to know very well. I used to live in the East End, you know, for 20 years. Now, round about Brick Lane, you've got round about Fashion Street, which is the scene of where some of the victims of Jack the Ripper had been killed. Now, that had been one of those areas where people had arrived, it was a rundown area, and people had arrived from other countries. You had Russian Jews had arrived at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. Before that, you had Huguenots who had escaped from persecutions in France and from Belgium. These were like Protestant people who ended up setting up weavers and tailors companies. And so then later Jewish people moved in and you had Jewish tailors were replacing them. And then more recently, as the Jews who had moved there became more affluent, integrated and moved on to different places in the 60s, in Brick Lane and Regents around Fashion Street, you had a load of Pakistani and Bangladeshi Muslims that are mostly Bangladeshi in that particular region. And they also have carried on with the fabric trade, which had been started off by the Huguenots in the 17th century, carried on by the Jewish tailors, and now you have the there's still a fabric trade, and there's now the leather trade as well, of clothes, coats and things. It's so you have, it's quite normal to have waves of migration taking over. What is happening now within those communities is a radicalizing by a small minority of people who are bullying people within the Muslim community to conform to Islamism. And what that also means is that now, where Jack the Ripper, when they had the Jewish tailors and when they had, you know, before that, the Huguenots, the descendants of the Huguenots doing their sewing and making of cloth, you used to have prostitutes, which is what Jack the Ripper's victims were. They were all around that region. And, you know, as I said, Fashion Street, it wasn't called that then, but that was where Mary Kelly, one of the last victims of Jack the Ripper, got killed. You know, she was pretty horrific. You know, she was, the skin was whittled away off her body. But what happened, that prostitution had been rampant in the Victorian era, and it had carried on. I used to go and see friends down, or just off Fashion Street, and I would constantly get propositioned by prostitutes. And then what happened was, the Islamists then started threatening to beat up the women. And then it got worse than that. The people who went around that region late at night, who weren't Muslim, who weren't going to the... Brick Lane was a trendy area, had restaurants, and it had art centres, and people would go to Brick Lane to be entertained, but then go back to their homes. But if people were around that region after 2 o'clock and they weren't Muslim, they would get attacked. You know, this is sort of the other side of multiculturalism, is that multiculturalism doesn't encourage integration. It doesn't encourage creating a one society. And the group that is most active in Europe in not integrating is obviously Muslims. So I can't answer your question and say one country, because how do you define a country? If you listen to the idiots in Britain's Parliament, if you listen to the idiots who appear on British television or the idiots who speak on Radio 4, you would get a view of this country which is totally unlike what is going on the ground. When you don't give people a voice, you end up with people having... you have an underground, and I think there are a lot of people who are resisting of Islam. People keep on saying that, oh, Europe is, it's gone, Europe is, I think Europe is just biding its time. I think there are only so much insults, there are only so much assaults on your values, until eventually people will react. I mean, most people don't want to have racism. They are quite happy to have people of different ethnic origins living around them, and that's great. But what's happening with Islamism, it's bullying Muslims as well. It's forcing them to conform. This is what Al-Mujahharoon used to do and Hizb ut-Tahrir used to do in universities, which is why Hizb ut-Tahrir is banned from all university campuses officially. Because they used to attack Muslim girls, or girls who looked like they were Muslim, forcing them to wear veils, using violence and threats. You know, it is something that... It's a small minority of activists who are poisoning things for the Muslims who do want to integrate, or at least who want to just live their lives without being forced one way or another. They are being pressured to conform, and they are also being pressured to then argue for halal food in schools. And then you get a lot of class of useful idiots. For example, you get teachers who give school kids... there was a case of a teacher who was getting a child, her children in her school for a handwriting test. She was a non-Muslim. She was getting the children in her school to do a handwriting test in her class, writing out the Shahada, the Muslim declaration of becoming a Muslim, of adopting Islam for the rest of your life. And these were children aged only 7. You know, and unfortunately, these useful idiots are poisoning the water and pushing it even further. And eventually, the combination of Islamists and useful idiots who enable the Islamists are eventually going to create a backlash. I don't support the EDL. I don't I don't attack the EDL. I don't support it. I don't agree with its policies of suddenly appearing in a town centre and going, oh, we hate, you know, Islamism, or we hate... Because what it does is it actually... It makes everybody sorry for the Muslims. You know, they don't actually do anything. They actually make it more difficult. But what they do do is show at least that there are some people who are prepared to stand up for something, even if they're a bit nebulous, they're not sure of what they that something that they stand for actually is. But it's a difficult one. It does attract morons. You know, I personally don't agree with any form of racial or ethnic antagonism. I think that's a very destructive. It's a destructive path if you start going down that line. But unfortunately, you know, we have so many people forced to live on top of each other, and you get this sense of, with multiculturalism, of this competition that then, you know, people feel they've got to compete against each other to get a slice of the cake. And you get cases where it seems that Muslims have been getting special treatment, and these get reported in the media. And it's not just in Britain, it's in Germany. I mean, there's a woman called Seyran Ates. Now, she was from Istanbul originally. She is a lawyer. Now, she has been dealing with protecting women's rights, mostly from the predominantly Kurdish-Turkish migrant community within Germany. And she's been working, she migrated in the 1960s when she was a young girl. I mean, she's about in her early 50s. She's got a daughter, a teenage daughter, and a few years back she said she was going to have to stop what she was doing. She was defending women who were being divorced and were having their kids taken from them, threats of violence, threats of honor killings made against them. And she was supporting women's rights within the Muslim Turkish community within Berlin, where she was based. And she had been shot at. And then when her daughter started being threatened, and newspapers as well were saying, well, this is her fault because she's antagonizing. You know, she, for a brief period... the newspaper Die Welt said that, you know, she was going to, she wasn't going to do any more pro bono work for people from the Muslim community, you know, defense work for them, because the dangers were getting too great, not just for herself, but because of, you know, her daughter was being physically threatened with violence, and she had been shot at, actually shot at one stage herself. This is what happens when you have these people who come en masse. They've been invited in from the 60s in places like Turkey. About 8% of the population of Germany is of Turkish origin. And most of these are people who just, they want to do their jobs, but they have very strong links with their Turkish origins, and they basically... within those communities where traditionally... See, what happened in Turkey in the East, when they started to remove the honor-killing mitigation circumstances, so that when somebody had been committing an honor-killing and could only get 2 years because it was within the law, when that was removed, there was suddenly a massive increase. It was right about 2006, I think it was, because it was November 2005 that Turkey had its last meeting about the accession of Turkey into the European Union. And by that time, it had ratified most of its laws to make them compliant with the laws and values which the European Union was imposing upon it. And those included meaning that anybody who killed somebody would be tried for murder, and not being told, oh, it's only an honor killing, have 2 years in jail and then get out and be treated like a normal person. When they removed those, women in areas of Van and Diyarbakir, I think the name is just the main city in the east of Turkey, girls were being forced to commit suicide. There was sudden a mass of suicides of young girls, corresponding with the average amount of people who annually would before have been killed in honor killings. And they had a special, the United Nations special rapporteur for women. She went and did an investigation and came out with the same facts. It was basically because nobody could force an honor killing onto a girl and actually get away with it, or have a very short prison term, what they were doing was they were forcing girls, giving them a razor blade or giving them pills and saying, you go away and kill yourself. Otherwise, the family honor will be besmirched and you will be to blame, so you must do it. And these girls would do it because they were under pressure to do it. You know, and this is a side of Islam and Islamic culture which, you know, in Jordan as well. In Jordan, if you commit an honor crime, you don't get this. You can claim that this is your right to have an honor crime. Now, I've got a couple of more stories which are on this, in which you're actually dealing with Australia. There is a case of a man who is claiming that because of Islamophobia in Australia, it was his right to. That was why, as a defense, he was scared of Islamophobia, why he shot a police officer. But before we get on to that, I've been non-stop boringly talking for, my gosh, 53 minutes of me droning on. Okay, we're going to play something a bit more lively. So forget about me for a minute. This is the Heptones.
Just why I'm calling you.
unbelievable. I mean, it really, really is quite unbelievable. What this story is, it's currently, it's, I'm going to put a link in the chat room because I think people should actually, if they have blogs, I think they should be able to blog about this. Now, there it goes. This is from Islamist Watch, which is a product project of the Middle East Forum, you know, run by Daniel Pipes. Now, David J. Rusin wrote this article. Now, back in November 2005, around about that time, there was a lot of problem with the Cronulla Beach riots. You had a lot of, there was a lot of anti-Muslim feeling going on, and, you know, a lot of anti-non-Muslim feeling going on. But still, November the 8th, 2005, four policemen were sent to arrest a man, and in a Sydney suburb, they went to arrest him, and he pulled out a gun, and he shot an officer in the hand, and then he was shot himself and arrested. Now, this is back in 2005. Now, it's taken a long time for this to come to court and to be dealt with. In June of this year, the court case was ruled. He was then acquitted. He was charged with attempting to kill or grievously injure a police officer. He had shot at them. And the judge's decision, parts of the reason why he was acquitted in June of this year, was that there had been a vague and unsubstantiated anti-Muslim feeling in the community. So his fear of Islamophobia is cited as an excuse for him to have shot at the police. Now, he testified he was sick at the time and jumpy about surveillance and possible police questions. But Judge Leone Flannery apparently accepted that argument. Now, the verdict came out in June, but it was suppressed until September because on a court order, because obviously they realized this was quite a volatile and quite an amazing thing going on. This is amazing that he has been acquitted. And as David Rusin, he's quoting a columnist called Gerard Henderson, you know. Columnist Gerard Henderson ponders, would a Jew be entitled to cite a climate of anti-Semitism in the community as affecting the intention of an act which he, she had committed with respect to police? What about a Hindu? To ask these questions is to answer them. Jews, Hindus, and others are treated like adults. Muslims frequently are viewed as children lacking self-control. Islamophobia is no longer just a tool to silence critics of Islamism. In at least one jurisdiction, it has morphed into a legal defense for terrorists who shoot cops. If there is any remaining doubt regarding the pernicious trajectory of the Islamophobia meme, the above case should dispel it. Now, that's one thing from Australia, which is quite shocking. Now, I think people should read vinayanko.com. We have Vin, I believe, still in the chat room. Yes, he's there. And I'm sure he has more information on that. Now, let me just go. We've had the Star of David attack in St. Louis. Now, this is a story from today. Well, now it would be yesterday. You know, in Australia, it's virtually 24 hours ahead of everybody, time-wise. Now, in the Australian, in the Business Legal Affairs section, there's a story that local Islamists draw on British success in bid for Sharia law. Now, the Federation of Islamic Councils. Now, these are this has had, through its years, it's had quite a few scandals, and there have been infighting, there have been Fijians fighting with Pakistanis, fighting with people of Arabic origin about who's going to control the Federation of Islamic Councils. And most regions in Australia, they used to have, I think it was 16 different divisions they used to have. But basically, because in Britain you have already got Islamic Sharia courts working in divorce cases in conjunction with the British courts, if people decide to go to arbitration, and if the two parties in a divorce court or a marriage issue, they about custody, issues of family law, if the two people involved agree to arbitration and for that arbitration to be carried out by a Sharia court, of which we have about 135 in Britain at present, then the decisions of the Sharia court then become legally binding, because these people have then signed an affidavit, they've testified in a court of law before a judge or a magistrate that they are going to have their divorce case arbitrated by a Sharia council or a Sharia court. Now, because of that, and now in Australia, the Federation of Islamic Councils, which used to pay the amazingly weird character called Sheikh... now, Hilali, who's his surname? Now, Taj al-Din al-Hilali. Now, he was a man of Lebanese origin who was famously said, he used to be the imam, he still is the imam at the Lakemba Mosque, but he had been paid by the Federation of Islamic Councils up until 2007, after he made his comments that Muslim women, or women who didn't wear head coverings, were just like meat which had been left out without being covered, that the cat would come and eat it. So if Muslim women did not, or women did not cover themselves properly, how can you blame the cats for wanting to go and eat the meat? Because he was basically talking about women being raped, were bringing it upon themselves because they were dressing like sluts, i.e. they weren't dressing like Julie Andrews on a very cold day with double layers of tent material over them. Now, this idea of they are now in the Federation of Islamic Councils, they were funding, they were paying Taj al-Din al-Hilali a load of money as a wage to be the Mufti of Australia. I used to think that was just a silly title. There was a man called Kezar Trad. Again, he was of Lebanese origin. Now, a lot of the people around Lakemba, the Lakemba Mosque, are Lebanese. You had also had a very serious case of a man and his brother, Mohammed and Bilal Skaf, both of Lebanese origin, who had gone around in a group of forcing young girls who were non-Muslims, they were orally raping them. And basically, they showed absolutely no remorse whatsoever. So there was a lot of problem with these Lebanese Muslims who were in Australia. And there was another man as well who has made a lot of problems in Australia called... Sheikh Faiz, F-A-I-Z, who is Lebanese. I don't know if he's back. He went to Lebanon briefly. He believes that Lebanese law, Islamic law, should be above the law of Australia. He's saying that people who insult the Prophet Muhammad should be killed. He believes in Sharia law, you know, up to stoning of women and everything. So you have a problem. At the time when that last case that I just mentioned about the man in the end of November, you had the Cronulla Beach riots. These were between Lebanese Muslims and non-Muslims, gangs of white people generally against gangs of Lebanese Muslims, and really quite severe, unpleasant racial tensions going on these beaches. So that was the climate of Islamophobia. It's obviously no excuse for a man to, when the police are trying to arrest him, to then pull out a gun and to shoot an officer in the hand and then to be acquitted of it later. That is just absolutely unbelievable. But this Federation of Islamic Councils, they stopped paying the Mufti of Australia, Taj Eldin Al-Halali. They stopped paying him a wage, but now they are trying to introduce, using the divorce system, which is how in Ottawa they tried to introduce Sharia law at the end of 2005 in Ottawa. The same way, there's a woman called Marion Boyd there. She was a former prosecutor. She tried to introduce Sharia law for cases of divorce and marriage. And according, they are, the Federation of Islamic Councils is lying because it is saying that it's, they want to give Sharia law priority over Australian divorce law, but they are saying that they're doing it under the guise of helping Muslim women. And if enacted, according, this is, I'm just reading now from the article in The Australian, which is, you know, a major Australian newspaper. You know, there's a Sydney Morning Herald, and you've got the Age, the Melbourne Age, and it's one of the three main Australian newspapers. And it's saying, if enacted, this plan would prevent Muslims from obtaining a civil divorce unless they first divorce under Islamic law. This is not helping women. A Muslim woman cannot divorce a Muslim man. There is a question of a man, all he has to do to divorce his wife is in earshot of other people to say three times, talak, 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 I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. That is all he needs to do. And then the wife's everything should, you know, he then has to give her back any dowry money that had come with the marriage, but that is all he has to give her. And often he never doesn't even have to do that. On the other hand, conversely, even if the wife is being beaten up, she cannot divorce her husband under Sharia law unless an imam listens to her case. And very often in the cases of imams are chosen from the community. So very often if a woman's being beaten up and attacked by her husband, the imam would know him but would not really know her. So he's more likely to take the husband's point of view than her point of view. It's a disgusting, nasty thing that's happening. And when you get countries where you do have Sharia law and non-Muslim law working together, like in parts like Aceh in Indonesia, and particularly the system that you had in Malaysia. Now, in Malaysia, only 60% of the people there are Muslim. The rest of them, most of the non-Muslims tend to be either Buddhists or Hindus. You have Chinese people there, and you have in people of Indian origin. 60% of people are Muslim, but what you end up is a situation of what happens is there is a, in the Malaysian constitution, it says that people should be free to follow any religion they choose. But if you want to leave Islam, you cannot, because you have to go through a Sharia court. And what was happening was people were, for example, there was a man called Lance Corporal Murthy. Now, he had been one of the members of a Malaysian team. He was in the army. He had gone to gone up Everest, so he was a hero. Now, he had ended up with a disease a bit like motor neurone disease, in which he had lost control of his muscles. He was in a wheelchair. He was unable to walk. He was unable to talk eventually. And during this time when he was unable to walk or talk, he came to the end of his life, and then some so-called Muslim friends of his then announced that he had been a convert to Islam. His conversion to Islam, even though he was a Hindu, he had a wife, Kaliya Mantan, and she was, you know, Hindu. She had seen no sign of him changing his behavior. But because these people said that he had converted to Islam, there was an... In 1968, I believe it was, they had made an amendment to the law that meant that no issue which comes under Sharia court, they have the Sharia courts called the Siaria courts in Malaysia, then you have the civil courts and the high courts, the federal courts. But the secular court system cannot, according to this amendment, I think it's 121A of their constitution, means that you cannot, any issue that can be dealt with by a Sharia court cannot be arbitrated upon by a secular court. And so what happened was Lance Corporal Morthy, when he died, the Sharia court took hold of his body. Now, according to Hindu custom, his wife, Kaliya Mantan, she wanted to have his body cremated. And she had never seen any sign of him being a Muslim. You know, she said that, you know, he had eaten pork, you know, and used to eat pork up until when he died. And he could not have said his Shahada, his commitment to Islam, because he had this motor neurone type disease, and he'd also fallen out of his wheelchair as well, which had made him even further disabled and had led to him being in a coma to eventually before he died. So when these people said that he had converted, he was unable, he was physically totally unable to have converted to Islam, but because he was taken to his case was taken to a Sharia court, and because any doubt, obviously, well, you know, if he had become a Muslim, then he wasn't going to have a Hindu burial where you cremate the body. Islamic burials, they believe that you must have the body intact, or as intact as, you know, nature will allow, and wrapped in a white sheet. And the body was taken away against the wishes of the wife. She had taken it to the High Court, and the High Court judge said, I'm sorry, I cannot arbitrate on this case. Numerous other cases, that there are 13 states in Malaysia, each one of them has a Sharia court, and you cannot leave Islam. It is not allowed. The only people who, there have only been two people who have been allowed to leave, two of them were dead, and one of them was alive. And this woman who was alive was a Chinese woman who had married an Iranian man, and he had basically married her to get citizenship and had left her after a week. And she had gone back to being a Buddhist, which she had been before. But she was allowed to leave Islam. But there is a woman now, Kali, I can't remember her full name, but there was a woman who had been involved with the Sky Temple cult. Now, this was a group which had these amazing, huge sculptures of... There was a giant teapot and other things which were in Terengganu state. And Karania Ali, I think her name is. Now... Vin may be able to correct me on that. Now, she had been imprisoned. The Sharia courts have the power to imprison people for heresy. And because she had been a member of this Sky Temple cult, she had been, which was basically, it was one that embraced Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity, and Islam. Anybody could join, you know, and all you had to do was you wanted to believe in the unity of humanity. And basically, she had been imprisoned back in 2005. She'd been imprisoned. Her husband, he'd been imprisoned and had died after being imprisoned by that. They can send you on to re-education camps. I mean, the abuses that happen, and the most famous one is Lena Joy. She was a woman who converted to Christianity in 1968. Now, in Malaysia, at the age of 12, you are forced to carry a thing called a MyCAD, which is an identification card. And this says your race, and it says that your religion and your age. Yes, Kamaria Ali. Thank you, Vin. A 57-year-old female school teacher from Malaysia was originally jailed for 20 months in 1992 and again in 2005 for apostasy. Over 60% of Malaysians are Sunni Muslim. Islam is a state religion, and Malaysia claims to support freedom of religion, though Muslims are not permitted to convert to other religions. Thank you very much, Vin. That's exactly what I was saying. Now, she had actually gone to, I mean, she had been a scholar of Islam, which is what makes it even more important for the authorities. Kamaria Ali had been educated at the Al-Azhar University in Egypt, which is one of the most, it's one of the most intense, it's apart from the Deobandi, it is the biggest Sunni Islamic university in the world. Following that is the Deobandi one in northern India. Now, she was an Islamic scholar. You know, she had qualifications in fiqh, which is Islamic jurisprudence. Now, her husband, as I said, you know, he died. You know, they were both members of this Sky Temple cult. And Aya Pin, who's the name of the guy who ran it, I mean, he fled Malaysia. He had to, because he would have been jailed. Now, this whole situation with Kamaria Ali is, you know, one thing, but also Lena Joy, she in 1968 had become a Christian. Now, they couldn't stop her from becoming a Christian, but what happens is, because you have this thing called a MyCAD, it says whether you're, what religion you are. Now, her boyfriend is a Christian, and she's been wanting to marry him for years and years and years. And so whenever she has attempted to try to get her status on her MyCAD, it says that she is a Muslim. She's gone to court. She's managed to get them to change her name from her Muslim name to Lena Joy, her Christian new name. But so far, she's been up to the federal court. Every appeal she has made, she has not been allowed to change her religion. And then what happens then is not only that, is that whenever she goes up to court, you have crowds of chanting Islamists dressed in white robes going Allahu Akbar outside of the court to intimidate the people inside, which is what also happens in Indonesia. This is the thing about when you do have two types of system. 60% of the population is Muslim, but 40% are not. You also have the Orang Asli. I mean, if you try, the Orang Asli are the original people, they're the aboriginals. Now, people, according to the Malaysian constitution, anybody who is a Malay is automatically an original member, even though the Malays didn't move to that part of the world until about the 11th century. The Orang Asli have been there for a lot longer. They're the genuine original people. And the Orang Asli, they practice shamanism and stuff. Now, various parties, Islamist parties, you know, have been able to try to bribe people of the Orang Asli to become Muslims. But it doesn't work the other way around. Anybody who tries to convert a Muslim to any other religion, or to try, you know, even though the person isn't legally allowed to convert, anybody who tries gets a 3,000 ringgit fine. You know, Malaysia, on paper, it has a constitution. Okay, it does have, there are certain things about race in the constitution which are pretty bad. They have a policy called Ketuanan Melayu, which means that, you know, the Malay people are of higher status than non-Malay people. And this was something that in 1969 they had huge riots and things which had been brought about by Mahathir Mohamad. He'd encouraged that, you know, Dr. Mahathir. He's a rabid anti-Semite. And, you know, you've got this awful situation. You have coalitions of, in order for there to be any government at all in any period of time in Malaysia's history since 1949, when it had its merdeka or its independence, you've got this thing where you have you cannot have enough members to get one group in power. So you have this Barisan Nasional, which is like the National Front. It's an amalgamation of Malay nationalists, of which Mahathir Mohamad, his party, was, you know, tied up with, who were then linked with one party which represents Chinese people and one party which represents Hindus. But in the law, you have the Ketuanan Melayu, of the supremacy of the Malay people, means that Malays get precedence in jobs, housing, advertisements for jobs. It puts the Malay people, you know, they advertise specifically for Malays for jobs and nobody else. And America, you know, Malaysia is 10% of American foreign trade is with Malaysia. And America is doing nothing. It didn't do it under the Bush administration, and it's not doing it now. It's doing nothing to end this policy of racism and Islamic supremacy, which work hand in hand, and it works hand in hand in every of the 13 states. You know, I've gone on a little bit again on that. You know, I tend to get lost on topics, and I have still got more things I want to talk about, but I want some tea. I'm getting a bit dry in my throat, so I'm going to play a very, very quick, believe me, I will try and make it quick, a very quick piece of music, which isn't going to be too long, and that'll just give me enough time to just make some quick tea and drink it so that I don't lose my voice. Now I'm looking, seeing ones which are like 2 minutes 48. I'm just looking for a very quick... Here it is. Alligator Crawl. 2 minutes 37. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Giving me a bit of a break there. That was Fats Waller with Alligator Crawl. Thank you very much, Poppy, for the offer of the PG tips. Unfortunately, I am a tea snob, and I only drink Wittard's tea, and I'm drinking apple crumble tea at the moment, which has got apple and cinnamon in it, I'm afraid. Thanks very much. I love the PG tips. Adverts with monkey and everything, but I'm afraid I've gone off normal tea. I only like the flavoured stuff. Anyway, right. Anybody who wants to call in, please do. Hole just disappeared. I think he got bored by my ranting with my monotone droning voice, which carries on going. Let's go through some of these other bits of news because, I mean, most of the stories which I found interesting, I mean, there's a lot about countries to do with... but have been, you know, things to do with social issues. Now, the issue that I'm also very concerned about at present is the plight of Pastor Yusuf Nadarkhani in Iran. Now, he's a Christian who is somebody who was brought up as a Muslim. And Iran's Supreme Court has said that he must, for the crime of apostasy, for leaving his religion, that he must be put to death. You know, the prophet said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. And this is something, you know, it's like Islam is like a lobster pot. You know, it happens in Malaysia. You know, people are open. Anybody can become a Muslim. But once you become a Muslim, you can't get out. You know, it's easy to get in, but very difficult to get out. It's just like the bloody Hotel California. You can check in, but you can't check out. Now, Pastor Yusuf Nadarkhani, now... Around about the age of 19, he gave up Islam, and he's been involved in Christian worship. He's been having home church services. He's been evangelizing, and you know, he was 19 in 1996, raised a Muslim in a Muslim home. And in his court trials, he's had several trials about his apostasy, and he denied that Muhammad was a prophet and denied the authority of Islam. He says he's a Christian, no longer Muslim, and according to Iran's constitution and Iran's Islamic law, he is now under sentence of death, waiting to be executed. And this is one thing that really I find ironic. You get these stupid, useful idiots like George Galloway, like that silly cow Yvonne Ridley, whose show I was invited on to play the token fascistic anti-Muslim bigot. They are happily having TV shows on Press TV based in a grotty little studio in a basement in Hanger Lane in West London. Now, I refused to be paid any money. I got my expenses for my travel fare to get there and back, but I refused to take a fee for appearing on their show. But these people get paid a wage by the Iranian government, and they have their shows, and they talk about how Israel is so full of oppression, and oh, isn't it terrible that, you know, you have all of these... horrible cases of Islamophobia, of Muslims in countries like Britain aren't given full rights to have halal meat. They don't get full rights to pray five times a day. And yet, they are in the pay of a country, Iran, who funds Press TV. Press TV is an organ and a wing of the Iranian government, which has women stoned to death for adultery, and which until very recently used to put children to death even after it had agreed to change its laws after pressure from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. It was still having underage girls. It was a girl aged 16 who was hanged for having loose morals. This was a girl from a broken home who had been raped. She had been sexually abused by family members. Iran is one of the most disgusting, hypocritical countries imaginable. Ayatollah Khomeini, in his Green Book, advocated the practice of thighing. Now, thighing is what apparently Muhammad used to do with his child bride Aisha when he was in his 50s. She was age 6 up until the age of 9. He got sexual satisfaction by putting a part of his anatomy between her thighs. And it is explicitly detailed in Ayatollah Khomeini's Green Book, which was written before he actually came to be the Ayatollah and to be in charge. When Iran became independent in 1979, for a long time, according to Islamic law, following the laws of Muhammad, it said that a woman, a girl, reaches adulthood and can be convicted and executed for a crime at the age of 8 years and 9 months, which is nine Islam. The Islam follows a lunar calendar, so 9 lunar years are 8 years and 9 months of a solar calendar. A girl reaches adulthood at the age of 8 years and 9 months, according to the original Islamic penal code brought in by Ayatollah Khomeini. And a boy doesn't become mature until the age of 15. So a girl could be executed at the age of 9. Now, there was a girl who, at the age of 16, was executed. This is after they had changed the law and made it so that, you know, people do not get regarded as being adult until they're 18. But Iran also has this disgusting habit of where women are stoned to death for adultery or publicly flogged, whereas people can indulge in a thing called sige, S-I-G-H-E, which in Farsi or Iranian means muta marriage, a temporary marriage. You can marry somebody for as little as 20 minutes for a quick shag and basically say that you have done that legally. And that's not adultery, you know, if the girl is not married, you know. And basically it is used for prostitution. For example, homosexuals are stoned to death or thrown off cliffs or have walls pushed on top of them. And apparently, according to a group, I think it's Homan, I think they're called, or 4,000 people have been executed for homosexuality since the Iranian Revolution. But because one person who was a transsexual appealed to Ayatollah Khomeini while he was alive, it is now legal to have sex changes in Iran. Now, people who have the sex changes, once they've had the full sex change, they are still treated by society as not being real women. They're still outcasts. But how they make their money, how they make a living, is through prostitution. They are then technically women, and they sign these sige marriage contracts, which is called muta marriage. Muta marriage is the Shia equivalent of a custom in Sunni Islam called mizyar. Mizyar marriage is the traveler's marriage, it's known as. And what basically it's doing is it encourages these people to commit prostitution to make a living. And yet a woman who has cheated on her husband, or her husband has left her and she has sex with somebody else, can be, and has been, women have been stoned to death in Iran legally for adultery. And yet this is a culture that allows prostitution, legal prostitution, under the guise of temporary marriage, sige or muta, and also allows thighing. And Ayatollah Khomeini, this is the shocking part of it, Ayatollah Khomeini says that thighing can be allowed even with a baby. Now, just think on what that means. And it's bad enough to have the Prophet of Islam having sex with a 9-year-old girl, according to the hadiths of Tabari and the hadiths of Bukhari. But thighing with a baby is what is in his green book. I talk about his green book. It was translated, and you can still get it on, I think, at the Prophet of Doom, Chris Wynn's site, Craig Wynn's site. You can still get hold of it. I believe you know, these relevant passages. And there's another woman, gosh, I can't remember her name. There's a woman who's got a website which also has passages where she's an Iranian woman, a doctor. She has a website. Next week I'll bring it up for you. But this is the whole situation of the hypocrisy and the disgustingness of what Islamic theocratic law has created in Iran. Iran is a culture. I mean, Cyrus the Great was the person who had the first declaration of human rights. Cyrus the Great was the person who freed the Jews from Babylon. There is a cylinder which has got, it's in the British Museum, and it was written on his authorization where he declares that the rights of people to have the freedom to worship of their own religion. And, you know, about the time of when he liberated the Jews from Babylon. Now, this culture that Iran had before Islam was a pretty vibrant culture. One of, you know, the, forget about that awful movie, The 300, where it portrays the Persian, you know, as, you know, monsters and everything, you know, cartoons. But the Persian culture, you know, of Xerxes and other people and Zoroastrianism isn't a pretty amazing culture. I mean, you know, Zoroastrianism is, you know, the traditional religion of Islam. Now, I'm a person, I love animals. Now, according to Zoroastrianism, you have got dogs, because dogs are, they help you, they protect your homes, they guard your flock from attacks by wolves or other animals. Dogs are regarded as sacred. Even hedgehogs. Hedgehogs are regarded as a type of dog, according to Zoroastrian belief. And when one town, when Islam took over Iran, when one town agreed to have Islam as its ideology, they did so on the condition that their hedgehogs in their gardens were allowed to survive. And the best creature of all, they believed, the mistress of the waters, for every 100 dogs that died, all of their souls were brought together and they made one creature, the otter. And whoever killed an otter would be murdered on the spot. Now, to me, that's cool. You know, I'm sorry. You know, if you interfered with a dog that was pregnant, or, you know, you attacked it, you would be beaten. This was part of their culture. They believed in respect for animals. Animals that worked with you. You know, and animals as part of nature. Islam doesn't respect animals. The Zoroastrians, where they have their dogs and their puppies, these dogs get abused horrifically. And puppies, you know, are killed in front of their owners in order to, firstly, to show them that Islam is more powerful, but also to just give them that, because they know how attached the, you know, traditionally Zoroastrians are to their animals, to their dogs. It's a vile, vile culture that Ayatollah Khomeini has introduced. Anyway, it looks like we have run over time almost. We've only got 5 minutes. So people have been leaving the chat room since I started talking about sexual habits of transsexuals and people in Iran. So show will be over very soon. And I'm sorry if I've offended people. I seem to have lost a lot of listeners. Anyway, Iran, this pastor, with his apostasy, because he has become a Christian, he is now in danger. And Yusuf Nadarkhani is in danger of being executed. So really, this is something that we should be making ourselves aware of. If there are various online petitions which you can sign up to, but I know I've signed for several petitions to stop people being attacked and killed, like Dara Darabi, and she was ended up being hanged anyway. But it's something; it's worth a try. Now, as we have people leaving in droves, I think, you know, my talking about sexual habits of Ayatollah Khomeini's subjects has been a little bit too much for people. I think I am going to... Was there a show? Thank you, Freedom's Wings. I will get my revenge. I will get my revenge. Okay. I'm going to play us out with some music now. And I'm going to play us out with something... I'm going to play us out with something spiritual for a change. Whoops. No, not Wajahat Ali. No, he's horrible. No, I don't want to play him. Right. Palestrina. That's not going to go.
Thank you.
Bit of dead air there. Sorry for that. Okay, well, thank you very much for anybody who's managed to stay till the end of the full 2 hours of my droning on. I should have had more music. I should have had more action. I should have had a bit more humph and chutzpah to have given it a bit more pizzazz. But still, we come to the end of the show now, and I'm not going to stay online for very long. And somebody called Poppy Poopy by accident. Sorry, in the chat room. That was just so funny. Right. So next week, we will be on at the same time at Friday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. This has been Adrian Morgan with the wonderful Reese Cup doing all of the interactions with the chat room. And thank you from the input from all of those who were listening earlier on, and also to Holger and to Vinayenko and Poppy and Freedom's Wings and Mary and Kingdom and a whole lot of other people who were on. And thank you. I will be back next week with Reese Cup, and I'm going to now sign off and hopefully see you next week on Global Security Matters on the Radio Jihad Network. And if you get a chance, have a look at familysecuritymatters.org. You'll find lots of interesting articles on there. Also, Vinayenko, VINIENCO.com. Check out his blog. Lots of interesting news about Islam, which is there as well. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll hopefully be with you again next week. Take care, and have a good weekend. Goodbye.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.